From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Prisons are, by design, secretive places. And it's not just the high walls that keep them relatively unknowable to people on the outside. It's also that prisons are often located in small, isolated towns. Communication with loved ones and journalists is monitored, and in the prisons themselves, there are blind spots, metaphorical and literal, where correctional officers can and do behave as though no one is watching. The latest season of the investigative podcast, Motive, from public radio station WBEZ, explores big prisons in small towns. The first episode of the new season came out yesterday and focuses on men in a Western Illinois prison who say they were beaten by guards in a rare corner of the facility that was not covered by security cameras. Nobody took action until one man, Larry Irvin, died from his injuries. That's just one story Motive will be covering this season. Let's listen to a preview.
You're going to hear a bunch of different stories, not just about Irvin, from all over the Illinois Department of Corrections. Sometimes they connect together, tangled like the system itself. We're going to go to small town parades and hear low-budget music videos as rural towns compete to win prisons and get jobs.
This is the season to find out the reason. Is we is or is we isn't going to get ourselves a prison?
We're going to go to a courthouse and see how judges and prosecutors elected in prison towns shape the way the prison functions.
So he went in for 7 years, and all of a sudden, he's not coming home for 100 years. And what in the hell happened that got us to that point?
We're going to hear a guard talk about plans to abuse prisoners and cover it up.
She said we were going to go into a cell and whoop up on him, and she was going to have me bite her to make it look like he did it.
Next week, we get to hear from two women determined to make things better from the inside out and what happens when they go behind the wall.
The inmates used to tell me that the guards were talking about following me home, and so they started telling me, stop taking up for us, Miss Bates. Stop advocating for us. They're going to come after you. And I would tell them, I want them to come after me.
This season of Motive is reported and hosted by Shannon Heffernan, a criminal justice reporter at WBEZ, who joins us now. Shannon, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, as ever, you can join our conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Or you can tweet us at 21st Show, at 21ST Show. So let's talk about just sort of behind this podcast. It's not one of those ones where you try to determine whether people are guilty or innocent, like, you know, Serial. It focuses on the people in prison, not how they got there. Can you talk about what makes your podcast different from the major true crime podcast genre?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think that usually when we're talking about crime and criminal justice, there's this sort of focus on innocence, like did people commit or not commit the crimes? And, you know, that's an important story to tell. Those are important things to figure out. But I'm really interested in what happens after a conviction. There's innocent people in prison, but there's also a lot of guilty people who did really bad things. And I wanted to wrestle with how should they be treated? What do we expect of the system that is holding them? And so we do mention, you know, here and there what crimes somebody committed to land them in prison. But we're much more interested in what happens to them after that conviction.
All right. So the first episode, it was released yesterday, and it's all about blind spots in prison. And longtime careful listeners with good memories might remember you and I actually talked about this story. I think it was last summer when you first reported a version of this. But let's go over it again. And this one blind spot in particular, this is a literal one, not a metaphorical one. How did you find out about it? What happened?
So the first thing that happened is we got a tip from somebody that a man named Larry Irvin had died while incarcerated inside Western Illinois Correctional Center in Mount Sterling, Illinois. And this person believed that it happened after there was an altercation with guards. And so that started us digging in and seeing what was going on there. And we quickly learned it happened or allegedly happened in this location of the prison where there were no cameras. And as we started pulling the string on that and talking to more folks, we kept uncovering people with very similar stories to what we heard happen to Larry Irvin. People were taken out of their residential housing, allegedly dragged to the segregation building with their handcuffs behind their back, leaned over. And then when they got to the vestibule of the building, were allegedly beaten pretty severely. We've looked at medical records that show broken ribs in multiple cases. In one case, there was a man whose injuries were serious enough that, according to medical records, he had to have facial reconstruction surgery. And this made us think that, well, you know, maybe this is bigger than Larry Irvin. So we spent the last year digging around that and learning what we could learn.
How common is it for, I mean, maybe you can give us a sense of, like, how much of a prison is not covered by a camera? How unusual is it to have, like, a little spot like that?
I would love to know the answer to that question.
No, that's okay.
Unfortunately, so, you know, prisons are fairly closed environments, so we don't really know that. I've been told that since we first started digging into the story, that particular blind spot has been covered with cameras. We do know that there is at least one other location in Western Illinois Correctional Center that staff and prisoners identified as a blind spot. I've heard about them in other locations, though proving up that they exist is difficult. While the Illinois Department of Corrections says they've covered that blind spot with cameras, they have routinely denied our request for footage of instances we heard about things that happened in those prisons. So while the footage is there, you have to remember the prison system is in control of where they place the cameras. They have control of that footage, and they decide when and who sees it. So even if you had it covered top to toe in cameras, there could still be an issue in terms of, well, who's looking at those cameras? Who's watching?
Who watches the watchman, right? All right. We have another clip here. Let's listen. This is a former incarcerated person who lives in the Chicago area now talking about his experience.
How many other people have been beaten? I mean, how often does this happen?
Society looks at us like, you know, we deserved it. You know, he's a prisoner. He in jail for something.
What's going to prevent this from happening to other people? So like, people need to be aware of this. This can happen to another person.
And it's only in extreme and severe cases that something is brought to attention or something is being said when they kill someone.
So how did you find out it was allegedly the same group of guards?
So in many of the cases we found, not all of them, the same staff were involved. And the way we were able to piece that together is when something happens inside the prison, people have to fill out incident reports. And often what precedes these incidents is some sort of conflict with the person in prison themselves. And so looking at those incident reports, we could tell who was transferring the person that day, so who would have been with them in the vestibule that's the alleged blind spot. And there are, I should say, from the incident with Larry Irvin that resulted in death, three guards were charged in that case. It's federal civil rights charges. And two of them are on trial right now. One of them has already pleaded guilty, but that's a trial we'll be watching very closely.
All right, we have another clip here. And actually, let me take a moment to remind listeners. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Shannon Heffernan, who is hosting and reporting the new season of the podcast Motive, an investigative podcast from WBEZ. She's a criminal justice reporter there. You can join our conversation at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455, or tweet us at 21st Show. We're talking about the first episode, which came out yesterday, which is about a blind spot at a prison in Western Illinois where guards could allegedly would take inmates to beat them, and in one case, allegedly beat an incarcerated person to death. We have a clip here from a lawyer of one of the men who says he was beaten in the prison. Let's listen to that.
This was systematic. This was guards who covered for guards. They clearly lied to me all the expense of truly somebody who was a victim. At one point, you stop being a criminal and you start becoming a victim. And now I'm angry at myself for not feeling quite so compelled to do something about it. I screwed up. I should have believed this guy.
What's he talking about there? Can you talk about go ahead.
A lawyer for Roger Latimer, one of the men who say he was beaten in this blind spot. And he went up to see his client, not about the alleged beating, but about another issue with his case. And while he was up there, his client says, you know, look, this happened. And the lawyer, he did try to take some action. He asked the prison staff, he said, for records of Latimer going to the hospital. And they told him he didn't go to the hospital. There's no record of that. And so the lawyer wanted to do something, but without documentation, he was sort of like, well, I mean, can I really prove this up? And so not much happened. When we did eventually get our hands on those medical records, it was really interesting. The nurse had actually written in her report that she and other staff wanted to take pictures of Latimer's injuries. And staff stopped her, guards stopped her and told her that there would be no pictures. And when Roger Latimer said he had to call the police and report that he'd been assaulted, the guard said, if he keeps talking about calling the police, we're going to take him out of the hospital and take him back to the facility. So you start to get a picture of, in order for a cover-up on this scale to happen, how many people would have to participate. And I think when Roger Latimer's lawyer is talking there, that's what he's alluding to. You know, this would have to be systematic. And that's something that's really has been important to us in our coverage of this. I think there's a way you can tell this story that is a story about a few bad guards doing something awful, right?
Bad apples,
but
right?
Bad apples, right? You know that cliche. It's almost corny at this point. But one thing we really wanted to do is we wanted to tell the story of the whole orchard, right? How did these so-called bad apples get grown? Who are all the people who are doing their job day in and day out, you know, in ways that may feel benign to them, but that are maybe setting up the circumstances where something like this can happen, which is why, you know, we're not just looking at just this one story. We want it to zoom out and look at a bigger picture of the system that would allow circumstances like this to go on.
Well, yeah, talk about that then, because one of the taglines of the program this season is big prisons, small towns. How does that, you know, the rural nature of some of these prisons, the distance from government centers, how does that contribute in your view or what you've uncovered in your reporting to what happens there?
Yeah, so of course, I live in Chicago. I've covered Chicago politics and police. I know scandals can happen in big cities, right? All the time. But there is something I think about the people who are victims in these cases being very removed from their communities. So the people who know them and can be in communication with them are going to have a hard time getting to them. Phone calls and letters can be monitored. And you also have like a really tight-knit community often of people who are working in these facilities. And we heard over and over again, not just from people locked in prison, but from people working in prison, that those tight-knit relationships enable people to look the other way and enable people to have a system of covering for each other.
Talk about some of the reporting you did on the prison sweepstakes. I gather that we heard the an allusion to a rap song, sort of like a cringy little clip there, maybe. Can you talk
right.
about your
So this is one of my favorite stories that we did. And I've covered prisons for a while, and I actually did not know this history. I imagine a lot of your listeners who've been around Illinois for a longer time might remember this, but there was a period in the 80s and 90s when we were building a lot of prisons in Illinois. This was under Governor Thompson. And that was because the prison population was exploding, right? You had Class X felonies law passing, which meant more people were being incarcerated for longer periods of time. And you needed prisons. And previously, historically, prisons were not something people wanted in their towns. They weren't thought of as good economic drivers. You didn't want to get a stigma on your town. But around this time, you know, it was a really rough time for farming communities. It was a rough time for factories. People were pretty desperate for jobs. So Illinois held the prison sweepstakes. And basically what this was were competitions to win prisons. And towns would compete against each other. And they'd pull all these kinds of wild antics. If you follow like how people try to get the attention of Amazon when they're locating their headquarters, it's sort of similar to that. These sort of stunts they'd pulled to be the place that that the government chose to locate their prison. So you had people doing chili cook-offs. You had these parades where people would dress up as prisoners and mm-hmm. dance to, you know, the prison rock, whatever. And you'd have one town made a rap video, which this is Flora, Illinois, made a rap video that became kind of famous. It got on like Good Morning America. If you can Google the video, or we'll be playing it later in the season on Motive.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a strange period of time that determined where a lot of, not all of these prisons, but where a lot of these prisons ended up located.
All right. We're going to take a break. We'll continue this conversation when we come back. This is the 21st.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Shannon Heffernan, criminal justice reporter at WBEZ, public radio station in Chicago. She hosted and reported the latest season of the investigative podcast Motive, which focuses on the hidden world of big prisons in small towns in Illinois. And before the break, we were talking about some of the sweepstakes atmosphere almost that went into some of these prison contests and the rise. Do you hear talk in criminal justice circles today of, you know, closing down? I mean, obviously there's the abolition movement, right? But even though we've seen the prison population shrinking precipitously, we still really haven't seen that much of a move to like close entire facilities wholesale.
That's right. Although there are some conversations happening in Illinois right now. Pontiac, for example, they're talking about closing some of the wings in those facilities. There's talk of Vandalia closing its facility. My understanding is these are not final plans, but it's something the governor has put out there, the governor's office, in terms of something they might do. And you're seeing pushback from residents and state reps from these towns about how that would affect their towns economically. But at a certain point, you know, with the prison population dropping as it has these last few years, you're not going to have the same need for housing people in prisons that you did before.
I'm curious. We talked earlier about how this podcast differs from sort of the true crime genre. I wonder what got you personally interested in reporting on people in prison?
Well, to be honest with you, I have had family who've been incarcerated. I've also had family that work in law enforcement. I've had family that work in policing and family that work in jails. So and there's nothing unique about that. A huge portion of the United States has a loved one who's been incarcerated at some point or another. In fact, I think for the amount we talk about it versus how many people are affected by it, it's just a sliver of that. So, I grew up with that being something that I was aware of as having a major effect on people's lives, and I didn't see that reflected in media. So when I became a criminal justice reporter, thinking about the incarceration side of things became important to me.
I know when I've done stories on people who are incarcerated in the past, sometimes you get pushback from listeners, readers that say, well, what about the victims? I wonder, mm-hmm. do you ever get that? And how do you respond to that?
Oh, all the time. And I think that it is very important to me that I don't shy away from the fact that there are people who are incarcerated who've done really serious harms to people. And I think that we have a whole desk here that covers crime, and it's important to talk about the victims and what's happened to them. But I think when we talk about victims, it's important to talk about what do they need and what do they want, and what actually helps them. And then to also talk about from the incarceration side and the system we have is, are those people getting what they need? Are the victims getting what they need from the system as it currently exists? So some of the reporting I've done in the past outside this particular project is like about the victims' compensation work that Illinois does or in some cases doesn't do. And so, yes, I think that should be a piece of the puzzle. But I also think we need to ask ourselves, what do we actually want to happen when somebody commits a crime? And I think that a large portion of the population does not think somebody should be beaten extrajudicially by staff, right? And I also think that it's really important for however you feel about incarceration to have an accurate and honest picture of what it looks like. So I'm not out here trying to convince anybody one way or another about how they should feel about prisons. But I do think there's this way that we have come to think of prisons as inevitable, right? As very, as just the way, as long as there's crime, of course there's prisons. And of course, if there's prisons, of course they look like this. And I think by taking an honest look at the prisons and the circumstances that exist around them and how they operate, we can enable people to think about that in a more detailed and particular way. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And I want to come back. You said, you know, you don't think anybody wants extrajudicial beatings, or at least most people don't. I would say, or judicial beatings, right? I mean, we have this prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment in our society. And something, a point that people in this world have often made to me is that most people in prison do get out of prison, right? It's not, as long as we're not giving everybody life sentences, we have to think about, you know, how these individuals will reintegrate with society and how they will be coming out.
Right, and what's good for us out of that as a whole society. And I think one theme we see coming out of our investigation is a lot of people who are incarcerated have lived with mental illness, live with trauma, and how is going into prison affecting that?
I want to come back to the case that we began talking about, this blind spot at the Western Illinois prison. Larry Irvin is buried in an unmarked grave in Southern Illinois, according to his brother, Willie. Does he know who buried his brother, or what does he know about the circumstances?
No, and we were never able to get that confirmed by the Department of Corrections or the state themselves. There was a lot of kind of, honestly, circular. The conversation got a little circular with people pointing fingers in different directions. But what we do know is his family didn't bury him. Somebody buried him in an unmarked grave. His family really wishes that they had put a marker there. They feel like it is sort of almost like a metaphor for what happened to Larry Irvin, that it's something that is a blind spot that can just slip under the radar.
Shannon Heffernan is hosting the fourth season of the Motive podcast from WBEZ. We'll have a link to it at our website, 21stshow.org. Shannon, thanks for talking with you. Good to talk with you again.
Good to talk with you. Thank you so much.